Hi, my name is Poe Johnson, and I'm here again with Within the Margins. And today I'm going to be interviewing Dr. Eric Martin, assistant professor at Baylor University in the Philosophy and History of Science Department. Eric or Dr. Martin, which do you prefer?
Eric.
Okay, Eric, so can you just introduce us to your research a little bit? Tell us sort of the scope of what you're doing, perhaps how you got there, and we'll sort of interrogate some of those ideas as we move forward.
Absolutely. Yeah, thanks for having me. Good to be with you. Very broadly, I'm interested in how science works.
Mm-hmm.
I have an undergraduate education in biology, and I loved doing the sciences, and I worked in a biochemistry lab for a little while, but I think my interests tended towards kind of bigger, more conceptual questions about science, like how it's changed over time. I only had a sort of vague intuition that maybe science was historically situated.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really know how to think about that. And unfortunately, it was only at the very end of my college education that I learned that there is this whole field called the history and the philosophy of science. And instead of applying to graduate programs in molecular biology, I thought to myself, yeah, that's really the stuff that gets me excited. That's what I want to learn about. I want to think about the place of science in society. I want to think about science and politics. I had interests in science and religion, and although I kind of read around these areas just for fun, I thought to myself, you know, I would like to have better tools to address these questions. I would like to be able to think about science in a more sophisticated way than I knew that I was able to back then. You know, I had some rudimentary understandings of cell biology and microbiology, which still fascinate me. But I think I wanted to do sort of more conceptual work to think about really how science works and the status of our knowledge and things like that. So then I went to a PhD program in the history and philosophy of science, and it's been great since then.
Okay, so where has this led you? What is this sort of like this wondering or concern, if I could use that term, over how science works, both sort of like in how it's politicized or how it's sort of turned into a sort of a public idea? Where has this led you to?
Yeah, so lots of places. So I did my PhD on questions and the origins of science. The origins of life, which is a great biochemical puzzle that involves many different areas of science. And so I was interested in how different kinds of scientists are and aren't able to collaborate with one another to work on this very explicit problem. You know, how did life begin? And it remains an outstanding question in science. In the course of investigating that question, which has to do with sort of how different theories can and can't work with one another, some of them are very traditional questions in the philosophy of science about reduction, whether biology and chemistry ultimately just all amount to a kind of physics and this sort of thing. In the course of investigating these kinds of questions, I was looking more at some historical moments in science as well, like the 1930s and 40s, at some of the early theories of origins of life, and I was reading widely in the scientific journals of those days, and I was just really struck, I think for the first time, at how different science was not that long ago, and what passed for sort of normal standard ideas was quite radically different. I mean, probably the most intriguing example of that being eugenics. I mean, in the 20s and 30s, eugenics was just commonplace. I mean, it was being advocated by absolutely everybody.
Absolutely.
We think of these things today as sort of a fringe, crazy, conservative, right-wing idea, but no, absolutely everybody was behind this, and I thought, this is amazing how this sort of ostensibly scientific idea had coalesced into such a broad ideology that had really affected lots of people's lives, some of them in really terrible ways,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
Mass castrations and different
forced
kinds
sterilizations.
Of forced sterilizations that, you know, continued for decades, and tens of thousands of people were sterilized against their wills. And this is a fascinating example of the ways that science and politics get mixed up with one another. Now, I don't think that's always a bad thing. Certain people use this term, you know, politicized science, to mean that something horrible has happened, you know, that politics has made its way into science, thus essentially corrupting what would have otherwise been the purity of that science. I'm not sure if we ever quite had the purity mm-hmm. of science that some people like to talk about, the sort of completely objective, completely insulated project that is free from any values. And so one of the things we're doing here at this conference, and one of the things I do in my research, is try to articulate a little bit more about where it is that values can legitimately be operating in the scientific process, and then whether there are also ways in which it's not okay for values to be part of a scientific process.
So let's explore that idea for a second. We'll go into sort of the talk that you gave at this conference mm-hmm. Through that. And that's the ways that science has sort of always been politicized, or maybe it's better to think of science as simply like a, in one element, obviously not in totality, a kind of political project in and of itself. Mm-hmm. So can you talk a little bit about that in terms of maybe give a sort of brief history, and then how it relates to what you, the paper that you gave in this conference today, or yesterday,
right? Great. So you're right. There's a sense in which because science is socially embedded, because science isn't cut off from the rest of society, right? Scientists are just everyday people who are mm-hmm. doing something a bit different and unique, and they're using these certain tools, but they're subject to all the same ideas that the rest of us are. So part of the original vision of science, I think, when we look back to the 17th century and some of the very important early institutions like the Royal Society, on the one hand, they had an ideal of science as being something very pure, being something very different, right? So they had rules that, you know, you don't talk about politics mm-hmm. and you don't talk about religion, and it's like grandma's dinner table at Thanksgiving, you know, you want to keep things polite, right? So the idea here is that science is the thing that is able to draw people together and to command assent in a way that few other activities could command, a sort of universal mm-hmm. assent. And this is what gives rise to this sort of idea that there's something objective that you can't help but believe this experimental result is true. It's a reason itself compelling you to believe something. On the other hand, there's a twin ideal going on, which is that science, you know, what is all this new knowledge of the world going to be for? What is mm-hmm. its purpose? So then, and as soon as you start thinking about sort of the implementation of knowledge in order to change the world, in order to make our lives better, suddenly we see that any such implementation is probably going to involve some of the murky disputes of politics and religion, because it essentially appeals to our ideas of what the good life mm-hmm. are. Yeah. So I think you're right that sort of values in science have been mixed up in different ways through history, not always for the worse, mm-hmm. But sometimes for the worse. The talk that I gave at this conference has to do with the idea of scientism.
Yes. Can you explain that idea very quickly?
Scientism can be difficult to define because, like some other ideologies, it is a sort of a sentiment or an urge. It can be a bit vague, but that's because it's often a bit unarticulated. But it's the idea. It's a very high esteem for science and for what it can do and for what it could be used for. So essentially, it's a way of saying there is something very unique about science that should be employed in all areas of human life. And another way of putting that is that science itself could be responsible for a sort of worldview that we have, in the sense of science could fill in our moral and political commitments. Mm-hmm. So science itself can generate a sort of total picture of the world that guides our actions, guides our beliefs, makes us think what should be done, what shouldn't be done, and things like that. This is the sense in which people sometimes say this phrase, I don't believe in religion, I believe in science.
Yes.
I mean, that's clearly indicating that their view of science plays some sort of analogous role in their lives that could actually sort of suggest what the right thing to do is, or suggest what your political commitment should be, or something like that.
So in the paper that you gave yesterday, you talked very specifically about George Lakoff and Steven Pinker, and how are these two thinkers who are sort of in different ideological positions, right? So like Lakoff would be more sort of on the left liberal side, and Pinker would be more on the sort of the right conservative side. So how are they both sort of using scientism, or are they both using scientism, or would you say that there's sort of a gradation being at play here, that they're sort of employing it and both not employing it?
I think these were two fascinating scientists to look at because they've made important contributions to science. And they're also very important public intellectuals mm-hmm. who have been positioned and who position themselves as spokespeople for science. So as a science studies scholar, I'm always interested in analyzing what exactly they're saying and what they're saying about science. They're interesting to pair together because, as you said, they've done some related scientific work. They're both interested in cognitive science and linguistics. They both come from a tradition involving Chomsky and thinking about mind and evolution and language. Mm-hmm. They're of the same generation. They've been trained in certain very similar ways. And I think, as I was saying in my paper, that they are both guilty of scientism. Mm-hmm. Yes. Guilty, I say, because there's two problems with scientism that... you end up appealing to science as a source of your worldview or your politics. But that's problematic because the appeal to science sort of flattens out what you think science is, mm-hmm. as there's a single univocal thing that science is, whereas in practice you see that they always pick certain parts of science to draw on their moral and political views.
Yeah.
So that's a problem. But also because they end up slightly inappropriately marshaling their own authority as experts in their fields. And I think that's very important to recognize what their expertise is, but also to recognize what it's not.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so they're able to make pronouncements on politics that marshal their authority in one area, but then they end up being these pundits who get sort of added authority mm-hmm. that I'm not sure they should have. So the way that it's interesting to look at them together is because Lakoff takes his work in cognitive science and says that this is going to be applied, you know, to the political left.
Yep.
And many of Pinker's views, not all, but some of Pinker's views take him towards much more traditionally conservative stances with respect to certain issues and government and gender mm-hmm. and things like this. So I think pairing them together is illustrative of the fact that, well, if you're saying there's some sort of move from science to politics, well, here we have two guys who are working very closely on important issues in cognitive science, but their political commitments go in opposite directions. You know, that keys us in to the fact that the source of those values must be coming from something other than a single thing called science.
Great. And so if you could just very briefly, as a sort of final question, can you determine how these things are functioning? So how does Lakoff, for instance, use cognitive science to try to, I guess, help the left would be the best way of putting it, whereas I guess Pinker would not be really doing it to help the right, but it's sort of like embodying the right's perspective.
Yeah, you put that very well. So Lakoff is self-consciously advocating for certain political positions mm-hmm. through his studies of an analysis of language. He's done very important work on metaphor and the significance of metaphor, not just as a linguistic phenomena. I think people were maybe aware of that in different ways, that we use metaphor all the time, but moreover as something that's endemic to thought itself. So cognition, he says, is actually deeply structured by metaphor. And he had an important theory about American politics as he was doing this work in cognitive science, and he was thinking about the different ways that human beings actually think in our sort of embodied states. He came to this theory of how American politics could be made sense of in a certain master metaphor, if you will. He says, what is it that unites all these, this disparate hodgepodge of conservative political platform? What is it that makes it all part of the same view? Because it's a, you know, they're pro-big government mm-hmm. when it comes to military, but mm-hmm. anti-big government in other ways. And he has this theory that he can make sense of this clustering and the differences between the Democratic and Republican parties by virtue of this metaphor, that we make sense of the big collection of the United States with appeal to the smaller collection of the family unit. Mm-hmm. So the master metaphor that he makes reference to is he says Republicans all take on the strict father morality, yes. whereas the Democrats take on the nurturant parent morality. Mm-hmm. These are two different ways of thinking about the relationship between parent and children, or analogously, political leadership and the rest of the members of a democracy. And he says this is the key to understanding how political discourse works. He says the old Enlightenment view that voters will all just respond by giving them more evidence about politics and about policy ramifications, he says this doesn't work. He says if we want to get more people voting Democratic, which is his political commitment, we need to craft new language. We need to make use of new metaphors that will get people thinking in different ways mm-hmm. about the significance of taxes, et cetera. And that if Democrats can do that, as well as Republicans had learned to do that, they would reap the rewards of higher voting. So that's the way he was positioning himself as an advocate for leftist political causes.
Yes.
Pinker, on the other hand, in his work, especially with evolutionary psychological claims, he really emphasizes universal traits, that mm-hmm. there's, in virtue of our evolutionary past, that our Stone Age ancestors, you know, evolved to solve certain problems, and that those have become fixed staples of our human minds. And I don't think anybody doubts that, you know, our psychology, our minds have certainly evolved. That's just part of the Darwinian evolutionary picture.
Yeah.
But the debate is over how much of our current everyday behavior that explains.
Mm-hmm.
Pinker is on the side of things that thinks that it actually explains quite a lot when it comes to seeking status,
mm-hmm.
when it comes to sexual behaviors. A lot of our everyday behaviors can be made sense of with these evolutionary psychological claims, that our adaptations in the Pleistocene era sort of tell us who we are.
Mm-hmm.
But by stressing these universal and fixed parts of human beings, he ends up telling a biological story that kind of justifies and naturalizes a story about differences between people.
Yeah.
And this is the political dimension of it. So he says, you know, men and women inevitably think different about sex.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe different groups of people behave differently in other ways. There's a bunch of different examples. And the concern is that he tells a story that minimizes the significance of history, of culture, of institutions,
mm-hmm.
these things that we know shape us quite a bit, but it's all a question of emphasis. And typically, critics on the left, and that includes quite a large number of academics, as we know, have been people more emphasizing the idealistic aspects of education, that if we put people in the right kinds of environments, then we can shape thought, behavior, these sorts of things, social dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you can go overboard with that.
Yes,
I mean,
absolutely.
I think one of Pinker's points is that he's trying to say, no, human beings are not infinitely malleable. But there's a lot of debates that's all in the middle. I mean, no, we're not infinitely malleable. But also, it's not the case that men have been designed by natural selection to be raping machines, as
yeah,
a few
absolutely.
Of the less sophisticated studies of animals have sort of extrapolated onto human beings. So we you know, ideas matter to us, institutions matter to us, the people around us matter to us. So of course, the kinds of critters that we are going to be shaped invariably by our natures, by our evolutionary past, but also by our current situations. But figuring out how those things all mix with one another is a very difficult task. So Pinker's views end up looking fairly conservative, not with respect to some social politics, but especially with respect to some gender politics and possibly about the limited role of government. These are things that his view ends up sort of embodying, as you say, sort of justifying or legitimating. But this is a political view that comes out of his work. So both Lakoff and Pinker are doing the kind of work where there's a political view that is implicit in their works, or sometimes explicit.
And I think that is a great place to end. I want to thank you again, Eric, for joining us today. And I'm Poe Johnson. I'm signing off on Within the Margins. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.